previously.
I came home on that Friday and I told my husband, we have to get pregnant right now. I have an 18-year-old daughter from, well, probably not that night. I digress.
We don't want to know what night.
You've been my big brother for quite a while now. Could you tell me something in love with me?
Why, sure, Arnold, I always do.
Well, how do you make a baby?
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hello, this is Dr. Natalie Berger of Texas Fertility Center. I'm being joined here by my colleague, Dr. Thomas Vaughn, and we are excited to welcome you to another edition of the Birds and Bees, Beyond the Birds and Bees, really. Before we get started talking about the important issues affecting fertility, I did want to remind everyone that if anyone has any questions regarding topics, questions about what we're talking about today, questions about previous topics that we talked about, or things that just in your mind, we have a call-in number, 390-1370. Again, that's 390-1370, where you can feel free to call in, ask us questions directly, and we'll be happy to give you our responses. And Thomas, you and Lisa were talking last time about some important things, you know, specifically how people can improve their own fertility. And that's so important because so often there is a feeling of a loss of control when people aren't able to achieve pregnancy on their own. And what are some of the other things that you wanted to discuss about that?
Thanks, Natalie. Yes, Lisa and I last week talked about what can you do to improve your fertility. And we talked about age, smoking, social behaviors, alcohol, exercise, and those sorts of things. And when we finished the show, we were talking about weight primarily with women. We're talking about that it can decrease the chance of a woman conceiving if she's overweight, but also if she's underweight. There mm-hmm. seems to be this window of weight that is ideal for ovulation. Mm-hmm. Primarily, ovulation is the issue with that. Now, there are plenty of women that are very thin that no matter how hard they try to gain weight, they can't gain weight. But really what we were focusing on were the women that may be of normal weight, normal size, and then go beyond normal exercise and become very lean. So there's this lean to fat ratio that is very important in regard to ovulation. Mm-hmm. Don't you agree?
Yeah. And is there like a specific range that you advise people to sort of maintain, like a sort of optimal fertility BMI or?
Yeah, there's two ends, of course. BMI probably under, well, a lean to fat ratio of 18% below that is going to be an issue for women mm-hmm. to ovulate. In terms of BMI, we really get concerned when their BMI exceeds 25, mm-hmm. and particularly when it exceeds 30. Mm-hmm. And remember, of course, there's issues with not only conceiving, but also with the baby being healthy. Mm-hmm. Because a woman that's overweight will make it more difficult. This will make it more difficult for her during the pregnancy. She's more likely to have problems with her blood sugar, what's called gestational diabetes, hypertension that can lead to toxemia, which some people call preeclampsia. So the importance of this is not only to help a woman conceive, but also to have a healthy pregnancy, which of course translates into a healthier baby.
And it's true that sometimes patients come into the office and may have a significantly higher BMI, for instance, and BMI being body mass index, a ratio of height to weight. And it's something that you can actually find pretty easily on the internet. If you go to the internet and type in BMI calculator, you can get a sense as to what your personal BMI is. But it's true that sometimes we have patients come in who have higher BMIs, for instance, 35 and 40. And even though ideally we would like for them to be below 30, especially below 25, I think it's also important to know that even modest changes in weight can make a big difference, not only in terms of fertility, but in terms of pregnancy success. It's true that with the high risk of diabetes, higher risk of blood pressure problems, C-section as women get heavier or have a higher BMI, we know that if they undergo fertility treatments, which also may increase their chance of having more than one child at a time, those risks can also be further increased. So it'd be ideal to certainly achieve an ideal BMI. However, even movements in the good direction, in the right direction, can really be helpful as well, too. And as we've mentioned before, actually, some people who have irregular cycles, even losing a little bit of weight sometimes for those individuals can cause their cycles to become more regular so they can ovulate and possibly avoid some of the fertility treatments they might otherwise have to undergo.
Yeah, that's so true. And we even mentioned last week that the first line of medication for induction of ovulation is a pill. And there's actually two pills that can be used, one called clomiphene, the other one called Femara, or letrozole. But some of the women can be overweight enough that they're insensitive to that medication. And clomiphene can be given, is one pill, actually 50 milligrams, but women can take up to 5 pills a day for 5 days. And if they don't respond to that, then we need to go to injectable medication, which is more expensive and a little more risky for multiple births. But just losing some weight may not make them completely ovulatory, but at least bring them into that range where they're more sensitive to these pills, which then makes it less expensive.
That's a huge thing because we know that Clomid is very inexpensive. Femara is also fairly inexpensive and well less than $100 per treatment. Comparing to having to use injectable hormones to cause ovulation, which can easily run multiple $1,000s per month. So there can be a huge financial difference. And for some folks who, again, may not even be able to achieve a normal BMI, but some improvement in their body mass index, some lowering of it, can enhance their ability to respond to these cheaper medications, these medications which also have a much lower chance of having risks of twins, triplets, and beyond.
You know, it's we're going to get into this in more detail when we focus on ovulation in a couple of weeks, but it's if this is the only problem a couple has, that is they have an ovulatory dysfunction, it has one of the highest success rates once it's corrected. And, you know, it may just be getting into shape corrects it on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So sure. So it's such an important issue. What we where we left off at this point, and we didn't have time to cover weight and men.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to finish up this segment of what can you do to improve your fertility to talk a little bit about this. And it turns out that I think it was mentioned a few weeks ago that fat tissue converts some adrenal hormones and male hormones into female hormones. And all men make male hormone, but they also make female hormones. And none of us want to admit that, but
sure.
we do. And it's the ratio, of course, that makes us different. And all women make some male hormone.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, when their weight goes up, they can make extra male hormone, and that can give them hair growth where they don't want, stimulate an appetite, make it a little harder to lose weight, change lipids, cholesterols, and triglycerides, and things like that. Well, when men gain weight, they're converting their testosterone into estrone, which is a weak estrogen, and when that ratio changes, that decreases spermatogenesis. It decreases the ability of the testicle to make sperm. So believe it or not, men can actually improve their sperm count if they get in better shape.
Mm-hmm. And there also can be some correlation in terms of libido as well, too. So in terms of decreasing the weight, improving sperm count, restoring a more normal hormonal balance can also be important regarding libido as well.
No question about it. Of course, libido is very difficult to understand because sometimes it's all in the mind, so to speak. But it is truly has some hormonal basis. And testosterone, as we know, has a direct correlation with sex drive. So if a guy loses weight, his testosterone to estrogen ratio goes up, and that would improve his libido. But there's also the psychological part a little bit, too. And that is just feeling better about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really, really important. And we see this with women, that women, if they're unhappy at their weight, and maybe their male hormone level's a little higher, and they do get in better shape, their male hormone level may go down, mm-hmm. but they're actually, their sex drive may go up. They just feel better about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, women are really, really picky about this, because they'll ask their husband, even clothes to wear, what do you think? And they think they look great, and of course they think that they're really overweight, sometimes but just a few pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the guy say, you look great, then they say, well, what do you know? You know, that's it's typical. So anyway, I think it's real important how we feel about ourselves, our mm-hmm. self-image. And so that is a big part of it as well. But the hormonal shifts are the most important part.
Mm-hmm. And I guess another thing that we wanted to discuss today was also the impact of recreational drug use and specifically marijuana use on fertility.
Yes, we did not get to that. And that's one of the final things in this segment that we wanted to be sure and cover. And it turns out that marijuana use in men lowers testosterone directly, and therefore this ratio is significantly altered. And actually, if guys overuse it a lot, they can actually get breast development. And
that's called sobering
gynecomastia. That's right. And so that can be a real issue. And there can be a little bit of shrinking of the testicle mm-hmm. when the hormonal changes are really profound. So therefore, it's almost like marijuana is a direct assault on sperm production.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that, again, a couple can do to improve their fertility.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly something that you may not hear a lot about, but it's important to know some of the manifestations or consequences of using something like marijuana on fertility. So I'm glad that we were able to bring that up.
Yeah, and I think also, of course, there's smoke involved, and we know that smoke is not very good for our arteries and other parts of our body. So, and we talked about that in the last segment, and that is, and let me just repeat it, that smoking in women can decrease their chance of conceiving in any given cycle 30 to 50%. That's significant. And to make matters worse, it can increase their miscarriage rate. So now we get a compounding negative effect, lower chance of getting pregnant, more likely to miscarry. So we have to keep all these things in mind so that everyone can do what they can do to improve the chances of conceiving.
And I think it's important to mention, I hear not infrequently frustrated patients who say, look, I understand what you're saying. My sisters, my friends, there's pack per day smokers, they drank, they did marijuana, they were overweight, they had no problems getting pregnant. So why?
How true is that? I mean, the bottom line is life is not fair, and so it is. There's no question we can find situations where people do everything that you think would lower their chance of conceiving, and they still get pregnant. This is really frustrating to infertility couples.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like seeing on television a child abused,
mm-hmm.
and they're going, we really would be such good parents and take good care of kids, and people that don't even care about the kids are having kids. And it is a real frustration. But here's the thing. These social behavioral issues don't eliminate the chance of conceiving, but they decrease the chance of conceiving. So we're talking with couples that are coming in that are having problems conceiving.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're doing is trying to improve their chances of conceiving, and but they're not contraceptives. That's very important to know. So other people who may be more fertile, maybe they're younger,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't interfere with their ability to conceive as it may be with this couple.
Right. And it's true. Like in a similar parallel, you may have heard about smokers, people who smoke 2 packs a day for 30 or 40 years and don't get lung cancer versus the person who's never smoked in their life does develop lung cancer. It's true that certain people are more vulnerable to certain things, and it's not fair, but certainly it's so true that we want to optimize the situation, because not always do we have an obvious sperm problem or obvious ovulation problem. And we're trying to tweak as many things as we can, especially things that we have control over, to help optimize success, whether it be spontaneously or even with the addition of fertility treatment.
Absolutely. And as we kind of finish up this little portion, I think it goes back to what you said at the first, and that is that we're trying to improve on things. For instance, we're not asking a couple to be whatever, quote unquote, the insurance company says perfect size is, mm-hmm. perfect height and weight and all that. We're just trying to get in better shape. Because
mm-hmm.
I said earlier, there's certain people that are very thin that won't gain weight. There are going to be people that in general are just big people.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to improve their health, which will make them more fertile and make it better for their child.
And when people are asking about different strategies to lose weight, is there anything in particular that you recommend regarding exercise or diet or develop programs?
Yes, that's great. And there's so many things out there. Let me just tell you one thing. My exercise is an elliptical treadmill. And I turn that thing up to about 170 revolutions, 10 degrees, 20 minutes. And at the end of it, I look at this and go, I have just burned 1/4 of a hamburger at McDonald's. And I'm going, are you kidding? I can't believe this. I thought maybe we'd have to call a cardiologist in. Point being, it is so hard to burn it.
Mm-hmm.
You need to watch what you take in. That is so important. Watch what you're taking in. And it's like the old thing, calories do count. Well, they do to a certain degree. Watch what you're eating, how much of it that you eat. Exercise is very helpful. Maybe burn a little bit, but to really decrease your appetite, mm-hmm. decrease your stress level. Because I don't know about you, but I do eat out of stress. Mm-hmm. I'll tend to overeat if it's a really stressful day.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and it's true. Building muscle mass in women also seems to help women metabolize food and calories a little better as well, too. So there seems to be more evidence that adding that to a exercise program can be really helpful for health reasons as well as fertility issues as well, too. But next, we're going to be talking about what it is that has happened in your past and how it can affect fertility. And again, feel free to call in at any point at 390-1370, and we'll be happy to take your calls.
And we're Talk Radio 1370 AM.
She's a good girl. Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Thomas Fawn with Dr. Natalie Berger, and we're from the Texas Fertility Center, and our website is txfertility.com. And we have been talking about subjects that we can help improve upon fertility. The show is Beyond the Birds and the Bees, and we've really started with things that couples can do to improve their fertility. And what we'd like to do is move into the history and physical, because when we see a patient for the first time, we take a history and physical. All physicians do that, and we do a complete history and physical so we can learn as much as we can about the patient. And obviously, we take a history before we do the exam. But what we thought we would talk about is what is important in the history and physical. What's important in the patient's past? And we actually take a history on the woman and the man, because this is a couple problem, and it's almost never his fault, her fault. Although couples seem to think that way, it's usually a couple thing.
It's true. Even when a woman has irregular periods or absent periods, and we strongly suspect or know that there is an ovulation problem, we can certainly not rule out the possibility of a sperm problem. And so it's, a lot of times the guys will ask, well, why do I do a sperm count? We know it's her issue, but we really actually don't, because it's not uncommon actually to have a combined issue. So
it's kind of interesting too, Natalie, because, you know, when we went to medical school and we went through rotations like internal medicine, and the patient came in with a problem, we were kind of trained to think there should be one reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try to put everything together. You've got a cough, you've got fever, do you have a pneumonia? And try to focus on there's one reason for this. But with fertility issues, there is commonly more than one. And part of that's, of course, because we have two people involved.
Right. And sometimes it's unknown. We cannot, with all of our history taking and test taking and such, not find a specific problem. It's possible that there is something that we do not have the technology or such to really be able to identify yet. But we are trying to search for any and all things that could be affecting fertility and optimize each and every one that we can in order to have the best chance of success.
And I think that that's real important to realize, that when someone hears the word unexplained, that does not mean that there's not a reason. It's just that there's a limit of how much you can learn. Now, the really good news about a couple that's unexplained is that the treatments for unexplained are really successful. And we'll get to that several weeks from now, but I think that's very important. And, you know, when patients come in so many times, they will say, we don't know why we can't get pregnant. Well, that may be part of the reason they're referred, because they can't. But remember that even if you don't have that answer when you go through the battery test, the success rate is still quite good.
That's important to know, because it's very frustrating to not have an answer. Some people feel like they could deal with the consequences better if they just knew why. but we don't always know why in fertility world. And we know that about 20% of our couples ultimately do have a diagnosis of unexplained infertility, but again, we have very good treatments to help out. And at this point, we'd like to sort of focus on the overall history taking and you know, what is important in terms of your past. We know, you know, one important thing that we start off asking women about is their periods. And very commonly, people will have an idea as to what's been going on recently. They may also try to give us more information about what happened when they were 14, 15, and what kind of birth control they were on like 15, 20 years ago. So some of these things can be relevant. Some may not be as relevant. And we really want to talk about what is important in terms of periods.
So that is important. We're trying to learn. We're not asking the patient, do you like your periods? We're just trying to figure out what are they like? In other words, are they regular? And if they're regular, how often? There's a big difference between every 25 days and every 35 days. Mm-hmm. Are they, and this may sound crazy, are they irregular? Are they regularly irregular, so to speak? All of those things are important. When did she go through puberty? Again, not did she enjoy going through puberty, but when did she go through puberty? And sometimes there's keys in that if they start their periods late. What were their periods like as a teenager? Not the detail of every month of every year, but just in general, were they irregular or regular? Was she placed on a birth control pill to regulate her periods? And now she stopped the pill because now she also wants to get pregnant. There's really good keys into the history of this.
It's true. And with periods, if you're on the birth control pill, you are being hormonally manipulated. So your period pattern on the pill or another kind of hormonal contraception really isn't as relevant. We are looking to see what your pattern is off of hormones. And specifically, how often are your periods occurring? Are they even as infrequent as every 2 to 3 months? Are they as frequent as every 14 to 30 days? Also, how many days are you bleeding? You know, it's very common to have women have a length of bleeding around 3, 4, 5, or 6 days. But 10 or 12 days of bleeding with a period would be fairly unusual. So that's another characteristic that would be important in terms of looking at with periods.
Yeah, also, when women have irregular periods, it usually falls into two categories of the reason. One is the uterus abnormal and there's something going on with it and it can't respond to normal hormonal stimulation? Mm-hmm. Or is it normal and that there is a hormonal imbalance that's not stimulating the uterus regularly? So that's why these histories are so important. And some people will talk about changes over many, many years. It's really probably most important what's been going on in the last several years. I wanted to throw one other thing in, and that is kind of how we approach the concept of infertility from the standpoint of the history. And patients will say, well, you know, we've really only been trying for a year. But when you really ask their history, they'll say, well, we haven't used contraception for 5 years. Wait, and that means condoms or pills or something like that. And so really, from our perspective, they have what's called involuntary infertility mm-hmm. for 5 years and not just 1 year. Just being sexually active for a period of 6 to 12 months is enough to realize that there's a fertility problem. Don't you agree?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, speaking of the periods again, another thing that we also like to keep an eye on is what is the pain or cramping pattern of your periods? Are you someone who has relatively mild periods? You take a Midol or Motrin here or there and do just fine. Or are you on 800 milligrams of Motrin every 3 to 4 hours and are in bed for part of your period? We know there can be a correlation between increasingly painful periods and a condition called endometriosis. We don't know for sure that someone has it based upon their period pain, but we suspect there may be a greater chance of it with the more symptoms, with the more pain they have during their period. They may also have other kinds of pain, like pain with urination, pain with bowel movements. In very severe cases of endometriosis, you can also have these kinds of components to your period.
Right. So there's a lot to be learned from that. And actually, if you turn it the other way, if a woman has really regular, predictable menses that are classically by textbook every 28 days, she probably does not have a significant hormonal imbalance,
mm-hmm.
even though sometimes they'll feel that way because they'll interpret that as maybe PMS or stress or something else. But that's a really, really good sign for a woman.
It's true. And then, you know, speaking of hormones, we certainly have a lot of patients who have very regular, predictable cycles every 28 days who try to use ovulation kits and never get a positive response. And we still feel there's a very strong chance that they're ovulating, though not every ovulation kit is going to be able to pick this up. And even in some folks, no matter what ovulation kit you use, it may not pick it up. But a history of very regular cycles gives you a very strong sense that ovulation is occurring because those hormonal changes are necessary to create a regular menstrual pattern.
You might ask, and certainly I'm asked, why would an ovulation kit be negative if you're really ovulating? Well, remember that what you're testing for is a hormone called LH, luteinizing hormone. It's released from the pituitary, gets in the bloodstream, and then gets into the urine. If women drink a lot of water, it could dilute it out so much in the urine that it may not be picked up.
And it's true that not all kits are equally sensitive. There may be some kits that are not able to detect a lower level of LH hormone that may be the peak level that a person would personally achieve during their ovulation time. We know that there can definitely be some variation in terms of sensitivity of these ovulation kits. And there seems to be the one that most people tend to like the best in terms of consistency and black and whiteness of response. And this is that clear blue easy one with the smiley face. It can be so helpful when you're trying to decipher between darkness and lightness of lines on some of the other tests that, you know, it can make you crazy. Using the clear blue easy monitors or tests, basically they give you a smiley face when you have your hormonal LH surge, which happens typically the day before you release the egg. That can be a much more obvious and clear answer for a lot of folks. But we realize that there still will be people who have ovulatory cycles who, even with that kit, are not going to have positive responses. And conversely, we have people who have, on their own, elevated LH levels, or the hormone that goes up before ovulation, who may get a false positive response. And classically, these are people who have more irregular cycles. So not always does a negative response say you're not ovulating, nor a positive response say you are ovulating. But if we use it in context to see, well, gosh, do you typically get your positive response about 2 weeks before your period? That would be a typical, that would give us more confidence that ovulation kit is indeed giving us the correct answer.
Yeah, it was very clever for that company to use a smiley face. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, because now, otherwise you're trying to match up something to a control. Is it pink? Is it blue? How blue is it? I had a patient say, I couldn't figure out how blue it was. I called my husband into the room. I said, how blue is this? And I looked down and now it's faded. He wasn't fast enough to get into the room. And so I was really mad at him. So this is really helpful to have the all or none.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that is important, though, is if you're using a kit that's whatever you're using, if it's working for you, mm-hmm. keep using it. You know, go for something that's inexpensive. There's not much benefit at all to the expensive monitors. Just the little sticks are all that you really need to do to learn when you're ovulating. And remember, this is determining when the LH surge occurs, the luteinizing hormone, and that's several hours before you actually ovulate. The beauty of this test is that you can detect before you ovulate that you're going to ovulate, plan intercourse or plan insemination of sperm. The basal body temperature tells you that you ovulated maybe 3 days ago, and you hope you just had intercourse 3 days ago. So this is a very helpful kit.
Right. And speaking of the basal body temperature charting, some folks like to see every single day, you know, what their temperature, their basal temperature is before they arise to look at for this very typical pattern whereby you have a slightly higher body temperature after ovulation. I find it personally very taxing to consider that kind of monitoring, and it can be flawed if you are sick, if you have an irregular sleeping schedule, It, again, doesn't give us any predictive value that you should be planning to have sex. You may be able to tell, well, gosh, you know, things worked out a few days ago because it looks like we ovulated a few days ago. But it's not unreasonable, but for a person who has regular cycles, and especially if they have used ovulation kits and have responded to those, I don't really see any benefit to those. I feel that people get unnecessarily stressed about them. And it's true that we don't typically need to use any of that information when we are deciding upon appropriate evaluation or treatment plans.
I agree. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but stress is such an important component of this. And the temperature charts seem to create more stress. And if we can do anything to de-emphasize that, I think it is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One of the other things, in fact, we had this question that came in, emailed, and that is infertility hereditary? Well, this just fits right into a history.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there certainly can be trends. For instance, how many times do you have, my mother had endometriosis, my sister had endometriosis, and you think, okay, you're more likely or predisposed to have it, but it doesn't guarantee that you're
right.
going to have it.
Right.
So, infertility, is it hereditary? Not necessarily. And there's some things that are not. I mean, particularly if you think if it's a sexually transmitted problem, that would not necessarily be hereditary. Maybe a low sperm count in a guy, that could possibly be hereditary because we think that a lot of that is on a genetic basis.
Also, ovarian function. We know that there are certain women who are going to have reproductive problems at an earlier age, and they may have mother or older sisters or such who were not able to conceive past the early 30s, for instance, versus people who have pregnancies well into their 40s and such. But we'll be coming back to talk more about how looking at your history can be important to talk about fertility issues and what things we should look for.
Yes, we are Talk Radio 1370. Any questions, don't hesitate to call us, 390-1370. We'll be back in a minute.
Hi, this is Dr. Natalie Berger. I'm again joined by Dr. Thomas Vaughn, and we are talking about the important things to consider in your history and how it could affect fertility. And another thing that we do ask patients about, and I realize it's a very personal question and it can be embarrassing to answer sometimes, is a history of sexually transmitted infections. Certainly, we're not trying to cause more stress and more anxiety, you know, during the time we're talking about overall the medical stuff. But it is important to know about anybody's previous diagnoses or even treatments for sexually transmitted infections. It's true that there are some infections that we don't really care as much about from a fertility standpoint as others. For instance, it's quite common for people to have a history of HPV or human papillomavirus. And yes, it can cause problems in terms of genital warts and cervical dysplasia causing pap smear problems. But it's true that it doesn't really have, in general, a very important effect on fertility. And it's true, so you guys know, it's a very, very, very common diagnosis. So I realize people are sometimes very reluctant to talk about it, but it is a very prevalent thing. And I think it's estimated that about 50 or 60% of college students are positive for HPV of some sort.
Maybe even higher.
Yeah, and it's true. It's interesting because more recently, even though we thought it was something that you, once you're positive for it, you'd be positive forever, now it appears that you may be positive at some points, but you potentially, in some cases, can even recover from the HPV. But in any case, that is a sexually transmitted infection that really doesn't affect fertility. We know the ones we tend to focus more on are the bacterial infections, and specifically because they can cause, they have a higher problem or chance of causing scar tissue. And scar tissue is so important because if your uterus and your ovaries and fallopian tubes are distorted by scar tissue, which you cannot even feel or see necessarily, this can make a major impact on your fertility. And people will say, well, gosh, you know, I had an infection in college and I was treated and they told me everything was fine and I don't have any problems now. So why would it be a problem? But it's so common to have issues even when you don't have any physical sensations. And though it's something that we can sometimes suspect when we do an ultrasound, for instance, if the ovaries and such are in a not common location and appear to be distorted, that gives us some sense that there may be some scar tissue. But it's true that typically the bacterial sexually transmitted infections like chlamydia, gonorrhea, are the ones that are the most important for fertility.
You know what? It's so important because chlamydia can be asymptomatic. That means no symptoms at all in the women. The men will tend to get a little bit of a penile discharge. They may have symptoms and go in and see a physician, but the women can be without symptoms and have it for a long period of time. And when they do go in to be treated, then it may have been there for a while and can cause tubal damage and increase the risk of having a tubal pregnancy once they do conceive. And it's important to remember this part of the history, because some people will have enough damage to block a fallopian tube. You learn that whenever you evaluate the tubes, but others may have damage that didn't block a fallopian tube, and just because the dye goes through the tubes doesn't mean it is not a damaged fallopian tube.
Right. And so, again, we do not mean to make the overall questioning when we talk to our patients more embarrassing or such, but we need to know of any kind of particular sexually transmitted infections that you've been diagnosed with in the past.
Yes, I think that what we're trying to do is that we're searching for an answer to why people are not conceiving. And there are treatments for these issues. So, for instance, if we really had a problem with chlamydia and tubal damage, in vitro fertilization can completely bypass the fallopian tube. And all other treatments involve the fallopian tube, whether it be timed intercourse, intrauterine insemination, fertility medications, or whatever. So if we knew that, we wouldn't want to waste all our time doing those procedures.
So true.
One of the other things that's kind of important, too, is that women that have had a tubal pregnancy, what caused that to happen could have affected the other tube, even though she's had a pregnancy in one tube. In other words, if she had a pregnancy in her right fallopian tube, the left tube may also be damaged, because usually what happens from scarring is that both tubes are involved in this, and that's real important for patients to be aware of, because that is a life-threatening problem.
And it's important to know that even if you received antibiotics or treatment for a pelvic infection in the past, it doesn't mean that you do not have possible scar tissue remaining. So, yes, most people, if not all, are hopefully treated by antibiotic medications if they're diagnosed with a bacterial sexually transmitted infection like chlamydia or gonorrhea, but this does not mean that you do not have the possibility of having scar tissue.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that you think would not be important, except for the question of is infertility hereditary, is a family history for other reasons. And specifically what we're looking for there is something that may be transmitted genetically, like cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy, those sorts of things. And there'll be an entire segment dedicated to this, but that's important because if it turns out that a couple has a recessive gene and they're a carrier, they may have a 25% chance their child could have the real disease. And so family history is really important for us to had that included in our total history. Now, what I usually hear from patients when they come in is actually about their sexual activity, because they're concerned they're not having intercourse the right way. Of course, that implies there's a wrong way. Don't you hear that?
Right, and it's true if there were so many wrong ways, there wouldn't be as many people in the world. Really, there isn't that much science to it.
Absolutely. Thank goodness. We wouldn't have gotten out of the caves, right?
Right.
I mean,
somehow the human race has survived
in spite of not knowing exactly
when to have sex.
That's right. So that's really not as big a deal. And I think it's real important for patients to realize that actually this is not about sex. I mean, it's because sex, quote unquote, hasn't worked. But I know that I'll still get these questions about frequency and positions and those sorts of things. And they're just not that important. I remember someone so focused on, it always falls out after intercourse, and they were so focused that that's why they can't get pregnant. And it'd be kind of like, okay, we'll go over here to the University of Texas, and everybody at the fraternity party have intercourse standing up. It falls out, and you don't get pregnant. I don't think so. I mean, my gosh. So we have to keep these things in mind and realize that it's not about that some we have to keep looking for the cause of things not working.
Mm-hmm.
So the history, again, is real important. I think what we do is that we kind of reassure our patients that it's not that they're doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that we talk about when we look at history is obstetric history, meaning any history of any pregnancies in the past. Certainly, as Thomas was mentioning, any history of two pregnancies makes our ears perk up. We know, as he was saying, that if you've had one tubal pregnancy in the past, that even if you had that fallopian tube removed, there potentially could still be an impact of whatever caused the higher risk to begin with on the opposite fallopian tube, and you may still be at higher risk for a recurrent tubal pregnancy, even if the offending first-time tube was removed. Some other things in terms of obstetrics.
You know, before you go on, I think, Natalie, that's a real important thing, because the chance of if a woman's had a tubal pregnancy, the chance of her having another tubal pregnancy is at least 15 to 20%. Mm-hmm. And that means in the tube that didn't have the pregnancy, the tubal mm-hmm. pregnancy. So it's, again, that other tube, it doesn't get away from our vigilance of watching it.
And other things that we look at also from an obstetric standpoint are miscarriages. We know that miscarriage is certainly a very hard thing to deal with. It is, however, we know a pretty common phenomenon. And depending upon which age group you're in, you know, 15, 20, 25% of pregnancies may be lost very early on. And typically this is in the first 5, 6, 7, or 8 weeks of pregnancy. But for someone who has especially beyond one miscarriage, perhaps like 2, 3, or even more than that, that's important for us to look at, because this is now moving into sort of a variant of fertility infertility called recurrent miscarriage. There are certainly a lot of overlaps in terms of what we look at for folks who have recurrent miscarriage as compared to infertility. But there are some important specific things that we want to look at. If a person has been actually getting pregnant and having a pregnancy inside the uterus multiple times, however, that pregnancy has not been able to continue.
That is correct. And, you know, the majority of those pregnancy losses, the cause is genetic. But when you have more, like if it's genetic even 70 to 80% of the time and you have three in a row, then you kind of think, maybe it's something else. Maybe how could we be unlucky so many times in a row? And that's when you start doing an evaluation to look for other causes.
Right. Because we certainly want to correct anything that we can, you know, above and beyond the genetics, which we know we cannot change the genetics of the embryo and thus the pregnancy. And it is simply usually a reflection of the genetics of the egg. We know that it's much more common to have miscarriages as a woman gets older. But certainly even women who are in their later 30s and early 40s may have other reasons for having recurrent miscarriage.
You know, I'd like to go back to the obstetrical history, too. And, of course, we would be remiss if we didn't say one of the most important things in the history is, of course, the patient's age. Mm-hmm. And we ask that at every visit. I mean, at every first visit. But back to the obstetrical history, there may be something that can give us an insight there. For instance, if the woman had a difficult pregnancy, she had a lot of bleeding afterwards, she had to have a D&C, that can cause scarring in the uterus that can be very significant. If she had a baby that came early, premature, maybe was breached upside down, maybe there's some malformation of the uterus.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things are really very important in regards to reproduction.
And certainly having a normal pregnancy in the past also gives us a better sense of ultimate success, but not always. So we in general want to get a good, you know, evaluation of the OB history to, again, help us to optimize the situation for success.
The history, there's so much to the history that we're going to pick this up next Saturday. As you know, we're Beyond the Birds and the Bees on Talk Radio 1370 every Saturday from 12 to 1. And Natalie and I are from the Texas Fertility Center, txfertility.com. We hope you have a good Saturday, and we'll see you again on the radio next Saturday at noon.
Let me tell you about the birds and the
Talk Radio 1370 AM.